Today, if you have seen, I have put as title to the lecture, Understanding Demands. And the reason I have put that title is because I think it's one of the most fundamental, or shall we say, one of the most significant fundamental items that all of us deal with all the time, from the beginning of our lives through the times when we become parents, and up to the end of our lives too. What is interesting about this concept of demand is how we take it for granted, how it becomes part of our life, how it becomes something which is accepted, something that we feel there's nothing we can do about it. And in this discussion today, I'd like to look at this concept, look at this situation called demands, from a couple of different points of view. Now, we are familiar with demanding, that is, the act of creating demands on others. It is something that basically you can say, in a kind of joking way, we are born into. When you are a child, when you're a baby, every mother knows how the child is demanding the need to eat. And it's not as if there's an option here. It is a demand. I need to eat. I need to eat now. It doesn't matter whether it's 2 in the morning or 4 in the morning or the mother's in the middle of doing 20 things. When it's time to eat, it's time to eat. And honestly, that's all there is to it. Now, what's interesting about that is how we as babies just simply accept that, that this is the way it is. Mothers are meant to do this for us. It takes us quite some time, takes us quite a few years to get to the point where we are no longer demanding so much, where we are also learning how to give, how to share. And in some cases, the demanding nature transforms into the object of demand, or that others are demanding of us. Let's talk about the mother again. Now, the life of a mother is a very difficult one. I was just meditating on this morning about how incredibly difficult it is to be a mother. Now, if you think about it, in the very beginning of motherhood, there is this carrying of this other being within the body. So life is no longer your own. It is now shared with another being. And that being has started to share your bodily resources, that which you eat, that which you drink, the way in which the extra burden is placed upon your excretory system, and the burden on your back, the burden that you carry physically, the mental burden, as the biological structure of that being within you grows, the burdens upon you increase proportionately. And then there's the demand of birth, which is just enormous, an enormous pain. Now, mothers don't really think of it like that, because there is a certain adjustment in the mind that comes from the emotional benefits that come from being a mother. So these things balance out to a certain extent the pain that is there. But make no mistake, it is an enormous, incredible pain. But there is, it's not like it's a pain like which has no meaning to it. Like if you just fall down and break something, that's like, we think of that as a meaningless pain. But this kind of a pain is a pain with enormous meaning, enormous purpose. And you would not want it to be in another way. Oh, of course, you would want to have birth without so much pain, but you would not want to stop birth just because of the pain. The whole object is that this child shall be delivered. So the pain has an enormous function, purpose, and one lives with it and says it is all right. If you think about, again, the same situation. As the mother grows with the child, as the child needs to eat, which we just spoke about, which means basically for many months, no sleeping at night. And then the demands that are being made upon you as a mother, for example, the husband goes out and works traditionally while the woman takes care of the children. Of course, now there is daycare. Now there are nannies and babysitters. So sometimes both are out working while someone else is taking care of the child. But often you will see the mother is feeding the husband, taking care of the husband, taking care of the house when husband's out working. And then the children, especially if there's more than one, will have so many demands for eating. They will make a mess everywhere. They will want to have facilities be driven to places, to have friends come over. You will have to bring them to sporting events or to playgrounds and observe very carefully what are they doing, so that they don't drag something on their head or eat the wrong thing. And when they do that, you will take care. You get the picture. There is a lot of demands on mothers. In the beginning, we start off being demanding. We have needs. In the end of our lives, we also have the same kind of needs. We are helpless, often laying in bed, often having somebody change our diapers, having somebody feed us. You will see these demands reappear. The demand to have someone care for us. The demand to have someone take care of us economically or medically or protect us. To carry us around, even if only in a wheelchair. So you will see in the cycle of normal life, you'll have being a person who demands on others, being a person who is demanded upon, and being a person who demands of others. It's important to know that we've had our share of demanding, and we have our share of being demanded upon. It's just the way it is in life. In life, we have to apportion, to divide parts of our lives into different segments. And when we divide our lives in these segments, of course, we don't do it. It's done for us. We accept different roles. Now, this form of demand, I would call this one that is, to a very large extent, based upon biochemical or external arrangements. One that is, to a very large extent, related to our physical bodies, related to time, related to simply the cycle of birth and death. That which is continuously going on and which is continuously putting a demand on us. If you think about it from a larger perspective, if we could just remove ourselves from our lives, we will see that this cycle which we are in is a demand on us. While we are demanding our mother to feed us as babies, our stomachs are demanding us to scream to be fed. Now, if you look at it from the higher perspective, you'll see that that's required. Because if the baby is not fed, the baby can't grow. And the baby's body is not the optimal form for action in this world. Therefore, the baby's body has to grow. And for the baby's body to grow, it needs food. The stomach is the biophysical indicator of the need of that food. Screaming when it's empty, screaming when the cells are demanding more. So the baby is demanded upon, and the baby demands upon the mother. Who is demanded upon? The mother demands on the father. Who is demanded upon? In other words, this biological system, which permeates our entire existence, is something which is demanded upon us by some higher arrangement. Life, as we see it all around the world, all around the universe, is something which is placed, something which is situated, and we simply take birth into it, and we have to deal with it. If you look at every aspect, we will see that dealing with demands is the main business of our lives. If you look at global warming, we talked about this last week, we neglected the demand of the earth for having a proper ambience and environment within which all personalities can live. We have neglected to maintain the balance. Maintenance is a demand. You have to maintain that which you have. This is a demand. Maintenance is something which is demanded upon us. And in that demand, we have to respond by taking care. I look, for example, at my yard around the house. The grass grows like mad. And if I don't cut it, it becomes so high, I could never cut it. So I have to cut it regularly. And the lawnmower demands gasoline. And I have to fertilize the plants. I have to trim them. I have to clean away the weeds. And all these trees are throwing all kinds of branches on the ground. And I have to clean them up. All in all, just this one yard demands so much of me. And I pay the price if I don't meet those demands. Now, I pay the price means I have to suffer if I don't meet the demands of nature, if I don't meet the demands of maintaining the nature around, then I have to actually suffer the consequences. So there are many demands made upon us by the earth, by the atmosphere, by the nature, by the air. So when by not meeting the demands, everybody suffers. Now, if we look at it, most of the time, we have to do many things to meet demands. Like we have to eat. you know the old list, eating, sleeping, mating, defending. These are demands placed upon us. These are demands placed upon us that we have to meet. Because if we don't meet them, then the biological mechanism within which we live breaks down. It ends up having disturbances which are very serious to us. And if you look at the amount of hours each of us spend in the day doing exactly these things, you will see how an enormous amount of time is taken up. How much time you spend on buying clothes, washing clothes, folding clothes, cleaning the house, cleaning the dishes, keeping things together. These are demands that go on every day. And what to speak, the demand of having to maintain your body physically so it stays out of disease. And when it ends up in a diseased condition, all of the work you have to do to cure it. Now, I find, I mean, at least in my own life, and I don't think I'm different than anyone else in this regard, most of my time is spent taking care of things. I mean, if you include sleeping, the great majority of my day is taking care of things which are demanded upon me. I was just laughing yesterday. Yesterday it was raining so horribly here. Such storms. I mean, it's nice to live in Florida and all that, but boy, do we have storms. So it was just pouring like a waterfall. And then all of a sudden, it would clear up and be nice. So my cat was getting really confused, Julius. He got really confused. So he was inside. He would look out the window and he would say, "When would this be over? I want to go out." And then the sun would come out and he would go out again very happily. And then it would pour down on top of him like anything. And, oh, here he comes right now. He knew we were talking about him coming through the door. This is funny. "Hi, Julius. We're talking about you." Yeah, you know that. Of course, your psychic cat. So then he comes in, you know, he just comes in soaking wet. And if you know anything about cats, you know the number one thing they can't stand is being wet, water. They can't take it. They'll drink it, but they'll never want to go in it. If you ever tried to give a cat a bath, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You basically give up. You don't want to do it. But so he comes in and he's screaming. He just stands right by his door and he's just screaming. He doesn't move. He's just screaming. And you hear it just like, "I'm wet. Do something." So then, okay, I got to pick him up and dry him because he insists. So I was just laughing. It was just very amusing how he just comes in and demands this. And he knows I'll take care of him. And I'm thinking about how children demand of mothers and how we demand upon teachers, how we demand upon others to take care of things, how we are demanded upon. I was kind of making a little bit of an examination, you know, a little research about all of the demands made upon me during the week. Just for example, how much tech support I do for people all over the place. People call me on the phone, cousins, and I do some tech support for some professors in some place. And my wife's computer had a problem and my mother calls up and says, "How do I do this?" And it's like I'm constantly doing tech support. And I'm kind of like, gee, you know, that's an amazing thing. My inbox in my email is I'm so far behind in my inbox. I think it's going to take me a week to answer all the letters I got piled up in there. And I'm thinking, you know, it's really interesting. At what point, you know, do I get to figure out how to do something for me? That is the question. You know, I was once in Heidelberg. There was a temple there. So I'm in Heidelberg, and I used to listen to the army base radio in English just to hear the news sometimes. Otherwise, I would hear the news on BBC with a shortwave radio. And because there was no like internet in those days, there was no way to find out what was happening in the world. And the German was just spoken so quickly on the radio, I couldn't catch everything. So I listened to it was an Air Force base. They had a radio station. And once, as I was going to tune into the radio for the news, I was waiting for the news to come on, and they played a song. It was a country song. They used to play country music. And I was captured by the lyrics. The lady who was singing it sang something like, "What about me? Doesn't anybody care? I gave enough, now I want my share. What about me? Doesn't anybody care? I gave enough, now I want my share." And I was just listening to that. And I really felt like a very kind of like deep compassion. The song was about a lady who was a waitress and who was, you know, taking care of so many things. And I was just feeling so bad for people like that, who really were screaming out to the universe, "But what about me?" When you look at this demand, this concept, now I'm not talking about specific demands now. I gave these specific demands in the beginning of this discussion because, you know, they were interesting to help us understand the situation of demand, the way in which it just pervades our entire life. But I want to talk about this concept of the "what about me?" How do I, me, fit in? When do I get to do something I want to do? Now, I know that just sent a resonance throughout this entire listener community. I know it. You don't have to instant message me. You don't have to smile into the camera. I know it. Everybody has this thought. It's just our situation as human beings. At one point, we get to this thought, "What about me? What do I get out of life?" That is a really, really significant question. And even sometimes it's an explosive question. It's like opening a box that's triggering a bomb. Sometimes when people open that box, they're a little older. And their whole life explodes when they even allow themselves to examine that question. The "what about me" question. What do I get out of all of this? Sometimes in a marriage, after a long period of time, somebody will just open that box, open that door, which they generally never allow themselves to open. Either in a marriage or in a work or in a family or any kind of a relationship with anything where you never allow yourself, with a sect, with a religion, when you allow yourself to open the door. Many people deal with it with their sexuality. when they realize that they're gay or lesbian. They allow themselves to open that door. Or even just being kinky or whatever it is. Sexually inventive, let's define it like that. Or let's say you any aspect of your life where you just artistic, where you just realize you're artistic. Or you're a boy and all of a sudden you realize you really like ballet. Let's just say you realize that and you're a boy. My God, I mean, like these are like opening boxes which society wants us to keep shut. And when these boxes open, it's like there's a string attached to a bomb and all of a sudden your life blows to pieces and you're blown up in the air and you're flying in the air and you don't know what's going to happen when you hit. Therefore, you know that status quo little gremlin who sits on your shoulder, who says, don't go there. Don't even admit the box exists. Don't try to change anything. Because if you do, and you'd even think of opening that box, kaboom! You're not even going to begin to imagine what's going to happen. So therefore, basically we just continue in our situation, force ourselves to accept it, because that's what's demanded of us. And either we just accept it like a martyr, you know, where you have your cross to bear, you know, you're carrying your cross and it's really heavy and you're like a martyr. So you're going down, you know, with your carrying your cross of life and you're just doing it like a martyr, you know, knowing you've got no hope to get anything together. And, you know, you're just going to suffer until you die because really there's no other hope. You're just going to suffer. And that's all there is to it. Because life is just a burden. Life is just demands. And you're just going to suffer carrying your cross. And the cross is ultimately going to crush you. And that's just the way it is because you are just a martyr. And every now and then you find yourself alone and you just cry. Or even worse, sometimes you pick up something and then smash it against the wall. Or sometimes you do other things. It depends on who you are. Sometimes people go out and kill other people, or they go out and smash other people, or they make a war. If they happen to be presidents or leaders, they do other things. Whatever, it doesn't matter. But the idea being that you can go through life like a martyr carrying the cross. Then there's other ways of dealing with it. Like, for example, freezing yourself. Turning yourself into an ice cube. Because you're not going to feel a thing. You're going to be so numb. And you go through life cold, detached. Nothing affects you. Nothing comes close to you. Or you philosophically explain it all away. Or you take so many drugs, you become numb. Or alcohol to be numb. Or so many other pleasures of life to make you numb. So you cannot feel anymore. Numb. What about me? Doesn't anybody care? Interesting. Does anybody care about you? Actually, who can even know what you want? Can you even really answer the question? If somebody were to come to you and say, what do you want? Can you even answer that question? Outside of all the things you do, even outside of just having enough money to do it with. Because sometimes we think that if we had more money, it would be fine. So that's our, what do we want? I want lots of money. Yeah, sure, everybody wants lots of money. But then, when you get the lots of money, what do you want? After all, the what you want. Is it what you have? What you have is something that you can deal with money. You can buy it. You can buy things. You can buy objects. You can buy vacations. You can buy sex. But you can't buy love. You can't buy happiness. You cannot buy satisfaction. You cannot buy that feeling that your life has meaning. Now, I could say many things about money, because what I like about money, for example, if I had a lot of money, you know, I like to do charity. That's what I like to do. If it's not exactly true that money can't buy you satisfaction, because I like to make a big foundation, make a big charity, invest the money in such a secure way it would bring a steady income. And then I would, you know, do things for people. Do things for people who can't deal with the demands of their lives. I like that. You know, it's interesting when you think about what do I want? Well, I can honestly say I like to play music. Not all the time. I really like playing with this new band now, us North Pole guys. It's cool. I mean, I like that. But I wouldn't do it all the time. I'm not a musician who would play all the time. I would lose my mind. I'd probably throw the guitar out the window. I got to do a bunch of stuff. I'm that kind of person. But that's a hobby. I like, you know, walking in nature. I like, you know, dealing. I like helping people. I like, especially like doing things for people. But not all the time. I got to balance it. I've got to have to take care of what's around me. If it's things are a chaos around me, I can't go on. I've got to have things organized and set up. I mean, sometimes people come to visit unexpectedly, and I apologize for my room being a mess. And they look at it and they go, "What mess?" And I say, "Oh, it's not organized with these papers and stuff." And they go, "What are you talking about? You should see my room. You know, I'm born this way. I've got this like Venus and Virgo jazz," my wife says. "Everything's got to be, you know, perfect. All that is around me, my environment, I got to have it all organized. And if it's not organized, I go crazy. If one food touches another food, I lose my mind. It's got to be separate. You can't mix things. It doesn't work like that." I read a survey. There's about 5% of the people who are like me. We're called picky. But really what it is that we like things very properly. So, okay, getting that together when it's all together, you know, I like to do this and that, but I like to help people too. Like, this thing here we do on Saturday, actually, who is this for? Well, for sure it's for me. While I'm doing it, I kind of like it. Sometimes I really like it. Before I start, I'm like, "Oy, what am I going to talk about? How am I going to say something useful, relevant, interesting, entertaining?" So I'm pulling my hair out, chewing my nails. And then I go sit in front of the deities. I have the best temple room in the whole world. And I just sit there. And then finally I get to relax. And I let go all that tension and all that stress and all of this pressure and all of the demands upon me. And I just let it all go. And then when I'm really relaxed, the deities say, now isn't that nice? And I go, yeah. And this morning they said, talk about demands. And I went, yeah. And then I walked in here and talked about demands. And that was really cool. So that was definitely for me something cool. Now, I also do it because I think to a certain extent, some of these things that I share with all of you are to a certain extent useful for you. Well, I suppose I would assume that because you wouldn't come back to listen if it wasn't useful or at least entertaining. You might find it boring or whatever, you want, might not come back. But if it was okay, you got something out of it, you come back. So as long as you come back, I'll come back. Because somehow I think we got something good going here. I mean, I like the facilities we offer on our website. And, you know, there's a lot of email back and forth, people privately messaging, wanting to know about this or that in their lives and asking if I could help some way. And, you know, I kind of like that. I kind of like all this where I can actually feel that my life has some value, that there's more to my life than just these biological demands, cutting the grass, drying the kitty cat, taking the dog for the walk, cleaning the kitchen, or whatever, taking care of me. So I like to think of life as having some higher purpose, having some other purpose, having some purpose which has some greater value. Now, I'd like to examine this what about me in terms of this whole concept of spirituality. Now, if you remember in the beginning, I said we would examine this issue of demands. And if you have Winamp, you'll see the video Winamp anyway. The title is Understanding Demands. Now, I don't claim, and I don't really think I'll ever be able to come up with an answer to this. This is not like a question that I'm going to answer. It's something which we're going to just understand. And here, I think, is the key to one of the most important demands, well, at least that I have, and most of the people I know also have, which is this demand to know why. There has to be a reason why. Everything has to have a reason. Now, isn't that what spirituality or religion or philosophy, these things are all related. Isn't that what these are all about? What about science? I mean, not just the science that creates technology, but I mean the science that furthers understanding of existence. Isn't that also related? Isn't this just one big search to understand why? Why is it so? Why do I feel like this? Why do I react the way I do? Why do I feel this fear? Or even put another way, who am I anyway? Now, I don't mean, am I some gopi or some, you know, angel or whatever. I don't mean that. I mean, who am I as a person? This is, after all, the real question. All these ideas of so-called discovering some identity seem to me to be like a, you know, giving candy to a baby, but that's another issue. Who am I and why am I here and what is life all about? These questions are dealt with in depth by every religion, by every spiritualist, by every philosophy, by every scientist, by every psychologist. Some deal with it in different ways than others. Some call it different things. But it seems to me we all deal with it. Every child deals with it. Every teenager deals with it. Every person on their deathbed deals with it. We constantly deal with it, but you see, we're so busy dealing with the things that are demanded of us and that we demand upon others, that these issues are pushed aside by the constant stress of demand. And therefore, you will see in religions or in spiritual traditions or whatever, the solution is given to stop demanding. Make no demands. You will even have these like extreme solutions to this being without demand. Like the Python methodology of being a sadhu, a saintly person, where you just lay down, do nothing, make no effort, and whatever walks into your mouth, accept it. I mean, these are given in religious traditions as a methodology. And if you think about it, that's like the furthest extreme you can go. Actually, no, probably nihilism is a further extreme, where this ideal of making everything absolutely non-existent, that's probably even a further extreme. But because that's basically a mental construction, I give this idea of being this Python, of just laying there, as the extreme on one end of total detachment. And then there's another extreme of constantly demanding and being demanded upon and just working to gain and get and earn and spend and enjoy pure hedonism and just money flowing and to succumb to every demand on in existence. In fact, these two methods are even considered to be useful methods of realization. To just enjoy so much that you become burned out with enjoyment and you don't care about it anymore. Just like when you eat so many of a particular kind of food, you get sick of it and you don't want to eat it anymore. Or you deny yourself everything and everything and just be the most austere personality you can be. It's not like these religious traditions have not thought of these things. They certainly have thought of these things. These ideas of extreme, and they deal with demands. These are considered to be part of religious traditions. And it's all a question of how you're going to deal with it. How you're going to deal with life. Now, I know one of the most significant demands is this demand to know why. And if you think about how people go through the process of self-discovery, they've got to deal with this why. Why is it so? Why am I so? Understanding. This is the key. To understand. Now, isn't it interesting that when you talk about this Sat Chit and Ananda, the being of life, the understanding and awareness of life and the capacity to be satisfied, to enjoy that life. Let's redefine these words. Eternity, knowledge, and bliss. I'm sorry. These definitions don't work. They don't work as words. They don't really explain what's going on. Satchit and Ananda, great. Put it in English or any language translated from English. Sorry, doesn't work. Eternity is something which is just like, yeah, it always was and always will be. It's kind of a meaningless term because it's something we cannot encompass and it has no practical relevance in our lives. But if you call it being, it brings us away from the ever existing in the past, always existing in the future, to the right now, the ever present existence of right now. Being. That is sat. The ever present existence. When you want to speak about why, or you want to speak about who am I, if you just have this first understanding that it is being, you have restricted your search to right now. Naturally, right now is a product of the constructions of the past. But we don't live in the past. We live in the present. We are a product of the past, but we are living in the present. We are producing the future, but we are living right now. So all that really matters is sat, being, right now, the present existence of life. Now, one of the most serious difficulties we have with this right now is being aware of now. Because we're usually worried about what we did in the past or didn't do in the past or what someone did to us in the past or what we did to someone else or what we did not get or what we got and lost. And lamenting about it, and wishing it was different. And much of our head right now is filled with complexes and complications coming from before. So even if we're living now, our awareness is forced into the past. Or else, our awareness is planning for the future. It was like this, it will be like that. Yet at the same time, demands come to us. Now, I find it very interesting. The more we live in the past or in the future, often the more the present demands our attention by breaking down right now. How many movies are there? How many stories are there of people whose marriages or families broke down because they were so busy living the past and the future, they forgot to live for each other right now? So this whole idea of awareness of right now is so important. And that is the chit, the being. I don't mean in terms of sat. I mean the being, the living being, the soul, the atma, whatever you want to speak about it. When that living being is in the present with its consciousness and its awareness is connected with the now, the questions, the why, become so much easier when this time, now, and the personality, me, are connected. Because then we see things in a totally different way. And when I'm here in the now, I can actually enjoy the now. Let's take, for example, food. You're eating food and you're thinking so much about the next bite. It tasted good when you first ate it because you were in that present moment. The present moment was to put it in your mouth. Oh, this is good, so I'll eat more. And then you jump ahead of yourself and think you're now anticipating eating more. So you want to eat more and get more and more. And because of that anticipation, because it was good in the past, and you're anticipating eating more, the present gets missed and you don't taste it now. Think about that. And because of that, you eat more than you should. That makes you sick. That makes you fat. That makes your brain dull. That makes you have to work harder to buy food. Therefore, in the Buddhist tradition, when it's time to eat, they sit down. They meditate on that food. And they eat as if it was an act of worship, putting their consciousness on the awareness of tasting each bite. That is a completely different way of life. Actually, that is the key to spirituality. Many Buddhist traditions are aware of that. The Zen Buddhist tradition is very aware of that. The present. We've spoken about the arrow, holding the arrow, never shooting it, or arranging flowers. These are just two examples. Because the whole point is to bring the consciousness to the present. Because when you're being in the moment, with awareness of the moment, the bliss of the moment will manifest. Otherwise, you're cheated of the bliss. Because you're always searching for the awareness, and you can't find it because you're not in the moment. This is the secret to spiritual life. It's not the solution to demands, but it is definitely the secret of spiritual life. And one who actually captures that secret has captured the essence of all spirituality. And when you're in that essence, it doesn't matter anymore what particular discipline you're in. If you like to worship Radha and Krishna, and you are in that moment, and you're being there, and you connect with them, you are aware of them, the bliss being with them is there. If you are just even meditating on the moment, on the food, when you, for example, think about people who, in Jagannath Puri, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was distributing prasadam of Lord Jagannath, and the devotees were talking about that enormous bliss of that prasadam, it's because they were meditating on the moment of it, on the moment of it, of the taste of it. Just like Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya once said to Lord Chaitanya, just try to taste what Lord Jagannath has tasted. An interesting way of looking at it, to try to taste what Lord Jagannath has tasted. To taste it the same way. This whole concept of being there in the now and experiencing that right now. If you think about chanting any mantras, it is the exact same thing. To be there now, experiencing the awareness of now. For example, if one in the right now were to say Radha, because of being in the now, the name Radha immediately carries the vibration of Radha. You can also do that with any other personality, any other personality's name, because it's the exact same methodology. To be in the moment, to be aware, to say the name, to feel the vibration of the personality, which thus encompasses the whole atmosphere of our awareness, and we are therefore there and connected. So when one has such capacity and one chants any mantra, any name, one develops that awareness, and if there is a bliss to be together with it, that will arise. Now, even though I could chant somebody's name, and any person, let's say I were to chant the name of Suddhodani, I would do the same thing. I would experience Suddhodani, but that wouldn't give me bliss. Not that there's anything wrong with Suddhodani, it's just that he's not a source of my bliss. Understand? I mean, I could connect, I could do it, I could, the name and the person, I could have that whole energetic thing going on. But bliss wouldn't be there. Understand? But if I say Radha, in that mood, not in a lecture like this, but before when I did it, it was so, there would be this connection, and there would be this love, and there would be this bliss, because it was all right now in the present. Therefore, when you chant in such an atmosphere, a mood, you could do it forever, because you're not living in the past. For example, in the past you did so many things, and these so many things made you feel that you were really something. You got degrees in the university. You passed tests. You learned arts. You can play music really good, or you can paint, or you can act, or you can repair computers, or you can build buildings, or you can be a wonderful gardener. You have accomplished things. You are the perfect mother. You are the perfect teacher. You are the perfect anything. You're really good at what you do. And doctor or lawyer or... And this feeling comes with you into the now, and it gives you this idea that you are something. And so long as you have this idea about yourself being something, you can't really connect to the others, especially Radha and Krishna, with that same now concentration, because now is filled with all of that which you think you have become. This is called the self-conception of life. Many speak about it in terms of the ego. That I am all that I have become through my efforts, and therefore this is my identity. And so long as I have this identity, then I have so many problems, because I have to maintain that identity. I have to make sure that others deal with me according to my conception of me. And if they don't, I have to defend myself, or attack them, or screw their lives up somehow. Or I have to work to forget and ignore them, all because of this idea I have of me now that has been insulted by somebody else. The same works as far as disease or old age. I'm this young person who can run and jump and do things. And here is this old age coming, and one is fighting with it. Understand? Because it's not me, this, what it is. Or I had money, now I've lost money, so now I'm fighting with it because it's not me. I am a person with money. These things are there that we carry with us into the present moment. And these are things which clutter the present moment and fill the present moment. It's almost as if I were to take my room and it would just be filled with paper everywhere. I couldn't find my computer. I couldn't find my light switch. I couldn't find anything. It was just filled with stuff. And I was constantly working to file these papers and look for that one. Oh, I know so well about looking for things. Where is that thing? We gotta find that thing. And looking everywhere for that thing which has become lost. And so the whole life is filled with all this like clutter everywhere. And how could you possibly enjoy your room? So when the present moment is filled with things that have come from the past or which we are planning in the future, so many plans, we can't be there in the now. Now, I know all of this is in the Vedic literature. All of this is in the so-called impersonalistic point of view. All of this is even in the Buddhistic point of view. All of this is in Kabbalah. All of this is in the Sufis. You name it, you've got it all over the place. Because even philosophers, existentialists even, humanists, psychologists, psychiatrists, they all talk about the same thing. All the clutter that's in the now. And how to get rid of the clutter. How to get rid of all these things which are stopping the now. So the whole idea is to concentrate in the now. The whole idea is to be present now. That is the sat of it all. And the chit is the awareness of now. The awareness of right now. Without the burden of the past. Without the demands of the future. Without the demands of the present. Awareness. Even you are aware of the demands of the present, but you can place them in their place. I will take care of this demand, then I will take care of that demand, then right now I'm just totally in the present, totally in the now, aware of that now. Okay, I'm there, but what do I do? That's up to you. Like I said in the beginning, this is not a solution, but at least it's an understanding. What do you do when you're in the now? And again, maybe you'll realize you've got that box you've always been avoiding, and you may open it and find all these bombs inside that explode all over your life. If you are in the now and you are aware of it, you're also aware of your strength, and you also are aware of how this now has been taken away from you by the stuff in that damn box. And then you just fling it open. Of course, you feel really good about flinging it open while it's open and all the bomb is flashing everything into the sky and dead bodies are everywhere around you and you think, hallelujah. Glory be to God. Life is good. I love it. But then when you look around and you have to pick your way through everything and rebuild it the way it should be, you realize, well, here we are back with demands again. Demanding on others, being demanded upon, setting things right, organizing, setting up. It's the same thing. It's the exact same thing. But you're at a new level of awareness, a new level. You've experienced what it meant And then you look around and see if you've got any other boxes there. Because if you have any other boxes there, you're going to be a lot more respectful before you open them. And you'll deal with them maybe in a little different way. But you're aware. And whenever you want to be in the present, you can. Because you know the process by which it takes place. Anytime you want to be in the present, anytime you want to experience that now, the sat and the chit, you're right there. But what about the ananda? Well, for some people, just being fully aware of the now is pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. And they're connected to everything. And they're just really peaceful with everything. They've made their peace with everything. They are just really happy about that and very peaceful. Therefore, some people are labeled as, you know, this or that negative label by Vaishnavas, so to speak, who don't really understand the processes of spirituality, who only understand basically what they've been told to understand. But those who have a very deep understanding of sat and chit in reality will understand all the ways in which it is connected to, attained, and the way in which that peace you can experience through being, that peace you can experience by the awareness of that being. And then you've got ananda. Now, ananda is a problem. Not because ananda is a problem, but because when you start talking about ananda, you run into problems. My ananda is not necessarily yours. Maybe you want to move in that way. Maybe you want to move in that way. Maybe you want to connect here, there, everywhere. Different personalities or impersonalities or whatever you want. In different ways that you want. In different forms that you want. It's your way to find your way. When you have that awareness and you are in the now and you are experiencing that, the way you move from there is your own process of discovery, your own process of connection. Now, I don't make any attempts to hide that I love to connect with Radha and Krishna, with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, with Lord Shiva, Goddess Parvati, or Ganesh, or Saraswati, or Lakshmi, or even Hanuman, or anybody, Lord Nrisimhadev. I love this. Or even angels who help in different ways, or even the healing spirits of cats or dogs or plants. I'm fine with all of that. I think it's great. For me, I love it. You may change the names. You may change the methodologies. You may not think about it even in the same way at all. You may even do it in another dimension entirely, in fact, almost certainly. But the way we find that ananda is how we reach out in that awareness of that moment, the awareness of being. And we will reach out and find exactly what we should find, when we should find it, according to exactly what is perfect for us. And in that experience, we'll also meet things that we won't like. We'll meet things that we'll want to change. We will be seekers of the truth, not verifiers of a philosophy. There's a huge difference. We will be seekers who seek out and who render service in that atmosphere of awareness. That service can be to negate that which is harming ourselves or others, to heal that which is torn or which is damaged. To construct that which will benefit others. To establish proper foundations. And to connect and live within the energy and consciousness and love of our deity. That's not a solution. That's just our process. It's not an end result. It's a process. It's not a place. It's a process. It's not even somewhere else than here. It's wherever we are. Did you ever hear the statement, wherever you go, that is Vrindavan? It's a process of being, of awareness, that is connected to the living being. And all the bliss is a product of that process, is a feeling of the process. And it is our natural right. And everything else is an imposition. And I hope that this extremely detailed explanation of understanding demands has been of service to you. But I know I sure liked speaking it. So I suppose it has been of service to me.